Medic One. Medic One inbound to your facility. Emergency traffic on a 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. Following multiple gunshot wounds. CPR in progress. Patient in base. IO in place. We will be here in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello and welcome to the EMS Handoff Podcast. This is David, along with my co-hosts, Bradley Dean and Eric McCullough. We are your all source for EMS. Tonight, we welcome another distinguished guest. To the EMS Handoff Podcast is bringing forward a topic that I think we have seen over the years just dramatically continue to increase and affect the fire and emergency services profession. So we're going to get into that topic here in just a minute, but welcome back, Eric McCullough, our social media web developer, overall educator, doing all things for the EMS Handoff. Eric McCullough, Middle Tennessee finally thawing out.
Yeah, it finally thawed out. Now it's nice and warm. Got to go outside and get some vitamin D with the kiddos. So, yeah, it's a lot better. Now all the leaves and all the branches are down and not allowed to burn them right now because we're on a burn ban for some reason, which is a bummer.
Got to love it. So, so used to just hearing that from the north and then hearing everything over there. But then we turn around this weekend and see 70 degree temperatures last weekend before dipping back down. So let's go over to the East Coast and see how our educator that is keeping the visitors and citizens of North Carolina safe, Bradley Dean.
Hey, weather was nice here this weekend, so I can't say too much. We were doing another basic land navigation class for some of our people, and then I had to come in and do a couple other clinical things tonight. So weather's great here. Glad you're thawing out in Tennessee.
You know, it's one of those things. You know, we're sitting here wearing this nice Pursue gear and Bradley in his fuchsia shirt there. We're going to get into that. But before we introduce our guests this evening, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. They've been a tremendous partner to the EMS Handoff Podcast. And while the handoff serves as your all source for EMS, in the podcast verse, GEMS has been an industry leader for the profession for many years. Go by their website and support their efforts to keep the industry informed. And also check out all of our prior episodes and our fellow podcasters there on the GEMS platform. You can also visit them on Apple, Spotify, and Google. And like I was saying, you can go to Pursue Outfitters for the EMS handoff merchandise. Pursue Apparel is available. PursueOutfitters.com/EMS handoff. So Bradley, go ahead and introduce our guest that we have so we can get into this topic because there's going to be a lot to talk about.
So tonight we've got Kurt Verone with us. He's has over 40 years of experience in the fire service. He retired in 2008 as a deputy assistant chief with Providence, Rhode Island Fire Department. He's currently a practicing attorney licensed in both Rhode Island and Maine. He served as the director of Public Fire Protection District, division at the NFPA. He's written two books, Legal Considerations for Fire Emergency Services, which often lays on my desk, and Fire Officer's Legal Handbook. He's a contributing editor for Firehouse Magazine and writes the Fire Law column. He remains active as a deputy chief with one of the fire departments in Rhode Island. Kurt, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Welcome, Chief. I think if somebody in this profession doesn't know your name, it would be highly suspect. They're brand new. They haven't been around for very long, but you certainly have a tremendous amount of credentials, and you've talked about our topic this evening quite a bit on your blog, bringing up events that have gone awry, I guess you would say, and ultimately we're going to talk about social media. Personally and professionally. So, you know, being a practicing attorney and your background in the fire service, you know, kind of just real quick, what is your experience with the social media verse kind of been up to this point?
You know, this is one of those areas where I think
The technology got ahead of our leadership curve, and there was even the law is catching up with social media and trying to catch up with the technology. So this is, I think, unique period in history. And, you know, I left the NFPA in 2010. I left Providence in 2008, went to work for the NFPA for a couple of years. And starting in 2010, when I decided I really wanted to move more into the connection between fire and law, I started a database. And that was one of the first things I did when I left the NFPA. And the process of putting that database together involved pretty much like I was doing just before we started the podcast, you know, cruising the internet, looking for headline stories, looking for cases. I have a couple of places where I get the cases. And read the cases, read whatever's out there, enter the cases into the database. And one of the things that struck me in 2010 was the number of firefighters getting themselves in trouble back then. Now, Facebook was relatively new. You know, social media wasn't quite what it is today, but there were a lot of firefighters getting themselves in trouble. Today, it's evolved exponentially since then. And I can tell you, I think about the cases that I had back in 2010 through 2015. We've had more firefighters disciplined since George Floyd's death than I had over a 5-year period from 2010 to 2015. It's really exploded exponentially when it comes to social media problems. So it's a growing problem. I have no doubt if we don't do a good job, my generation doesn't do a good job from a leadership perspective and getting our arms around this, it's only going to get worse.
So let me ask you this, and you pretty much already answered it, but I'm just going to ask it straight out. Is social media going away anytime soon?
No, I don't have a crystal ball, but it's not, I don't see it. I mean, unless something is going to take its place, or, you know, we end up in the Mad Max world, you know, barring something like that, I just don't see it. And there's like an insatiable demand for what's going on in social media. Some kids, I think, you know, my kids were born in 1990, 1991. So they're in their 30s now. But there's a lot of folks that grew up with social media. And, you know, I think that they've accepted that as part of culture, accepted that as part. My generation, it was relatively new. And so we had a little bit of apprehension about using it. And I know my wife was very, very slow to adapt it. And she uses it now. But I think it's only going to get worse. And you know, one of the things I tell my clients and I say in my classes is when someone becomes a firefighter or an EMT or a medic, we don't assume they know how to, for example, start an IV, set up the EKG, you know, what the readings mean. We realize we have to train them. We don't assume they come to the table with those skills. Somehow, when it comes to things like social media and also picture taking and a few other things, we make an assumption that they know what's appropriate and what's not. And which it'd be ridiculous if we assumed that when we hired somebody, they had those skills. And on the fire side, we're talking about, you know, packing hose, stretching hose, wearing an SCBA and all of those things. We train them, even if they've got their degree, you know, they got their certification. We want to make sure that they've, you know, they know how to use our packs, our pumps, how we want our hose packed. We just assume that people know how to behave on social media. And yet case after case after case, we're proven wrong.
I'm going to make an assumption. I'm going to assume a digital native is less prepared to handle the rigors of social media than a digital migrant. What I mean by digital migrant is your kid's age, because that's around my age, mm-hmm. is we didn't grow up with technology. We got technology, in our 20s, I guess. I think in our 20s. But digital natives, of course, they've had that ever since. So my assumption is digital migrants would be a little bit better when it comes to social media than digital natives. What, or What do you, have you come across anything like that?
Yeah, I would think so. And I think what we're talking about fundamentally is boundaries, you know, and what's appropriate use of social media when you're off duty, is one thing. When you're on duty is another. And, you know, the technology, the social media technology connects, it interconnects almost inseparably with digital imagery. And so there's a coupling there of the problems. And sometimes it's hard to separate them. In my mind, I try to separate, I try to compartmentalize them. But, you know, when I was, I guess, I don't know if according to that terminology, I'd be a maiden or, but I grew up using a 35 millimeter Nikon, you know, and actually even before that, I had a Minolta, my dad's old 35 millimeter, but, you know, it's very hard to get yourself in trouble with a 35 millimeter camera, you know, a film camera. You think about, you know, what it takes to take a picture that you shouldn't probably be taking. It's not going to fit in your pocket. Then you got to go take it someplace to get it developed. And, you know, then you have a print. And so how do you share it with people? So there's some, the technology is self-limiting. The technology is not self-limiting now. And so the ability of people, and I say that because we see older folks getting themselves in trouble as well, not just younger people. But I think people of my generation would have a little bit more caution, whereas people who grow up with it, just, it's just, you know, it's like tying your shoes, you know, use social media to, you know, you go out to the restaurant for the first time, you take a picture of it to show everybody, hey, you know, I just went to this restaurant. Look at my meal. What happens when you go to your first fatal car accident?
You know? Well, and very, very much so. It's a great, very great point. So one of the things that you were mentioning just a minute ago was the fact that, you know, you have that new firefighter, whether they've come to you from another municipality and they are already certified, you kind of go through that process. And when we have those, you know, it's something we've been doing for quite a while. So we're kind of accustomed to handling how you stretch hose, how you pack hose, what a truck, an engine, you know, whatever it is. And we're not scared of that. And social media is not something to be, even as a leader, is not something to be scared of. It's just adapting that, figuring out what we need to do. So what role can social media play, if done correctly, in the emergency services community?
Oh, I think it's critical, you know, and I think, as leaders, we can't be ostriches to it either. There's some situations where panic can spread through social media in terms of an active incident, whether it's a hazmat release or even a fire in a building that maybe has some products in it. And, you know, you can almost role play. We've done some, tabletops with this type of thing, but where panic can spread through social media. And if the incident command post, someone at the command post, usually the PIO, but someone needs to be monitoring what's going on, because otherwise we can start getting false rumors about what's burning, where's it going, you know, what could potentially happen to someone who breathes in the smoke and all of that. But someone who gets in social media and starts some sort of a rumor, you know, could cause a panic. And this has happened in a couple of places. I don't want to get into the details of them, but it's happened. So social media, we as a fire department, we need to leverage social media. We need to be a player in it and use it to educate the public about our needs, whether it's shoveling hydrants, that's an issue up here, you know, a lot of other things, you know, wildland fires. And, you know, I know when I was with the NFPA, one of my areas of responsibility was the FireWise program. And, you know, just the issue of wildland fires was something that was a major concern. And again, you know, we can use social media to educate, we can use it to communicate. And I think this last year has really demonstrated how many fire departments have really, even departments that didn't use social media before, used it to keep people up to date. And now most fire departments in this area are using, and also the EMA directors are using it to communicate with citizens about vaccine clinics and, you know, where you stand on the list and a lot of other of the details. It would be almost impossible to communicate without social media. Otherwise, you're really limited to trying to have the news stations cover it, news at 6 or news at 11. And they've got so many other stories to pick from. And our stories, our information would just get lost in the, you know, in the time crunch there. So social media provides us with that mechanism to get the word out.
Now, as you mentioned, it can be a very big tool that we can leverage our capability and our reach. And so one of the things that I do know that some departments have looked at is, you know, for the most part, most fire and emergency services organizations have a singular PIO, one individual. Some of them, you know, the larger ones you get in like FDNY and LA County and such, they may have a couple others that represent different geographic areas. But for most part, that public information staff is very limited in scope. So if we utilize this property and as leaders adopt it and educate with it, we can actually use our personnel as force multipliers in that public information realm by sending out messages and helping proliferate that. Because one, you know, our PIO may have a reach of X amount, but if we add our entire team together, we may have tenfold, 100-fold people in the community, right?
Yeah. And some fire departments have really outdone themselves in terms of becoming the source for good information when it comes to emergency management. And that's whether it's fire safety, EMS, COVID, weather-related events, wildland-related events. Their social media presence, that fire department's social media presence, has become the voice in the community for, you know, for folks in the community to go to. And I think, boy, hats off to those fire departments that had the vision to do that.
Now, before you really even get into that, you need to kind of set those boundaries and what it takes to represent that department. You can't just say, here, you're part of our public information, go forth and spread news, right? You got to kind of set those boundaries.
Yeah, you know, it's easy. You know, it's almost like whatever you do, there's going to be a risk associated with it. So you've got to kind of figure out what are the risks. You want to make sure that you have somebody with the right attitude and skill set. And you don't want someone who's going to be your PIO that's going to get in arguments with people in social media, because it's like getting in arguments at a town council meeting or city council meeting where the media might see it and people might see it. It might be filmed. And, you know, so there's a skill set. I think there's an aptitude and a personality that would certainly be necessary. But there are risks, and some fire departments have stumbled. But I think, you know, some fire departments and fire chiefs are in a position where they can't afford to take risks, because their job could be at stake. And so this could be a little bit risky, just like anything we do. So, you know, if you're in a position where you're able to manage that risk and that you're secure with your position and that you could make a mistake, but you're going to be able to recover from it, then I think it's a good choice. I say that because I know there's a lot of fire chiefs out there that are on the ropes. And they don't want to. I think that's one of the things that causes them not to want to engage in this activity, because the downside outweighs the upside. But I think there's an awful lot of departments out there that have seen the upside, and it's, you know, there's a lot to gain by doing it.
So a lot of people think that when they leave the station, they take off that shirt. Mm-hmm. And they leave, that they're off duty, and that's completely separating anything from their personal lives to their professional lives. But in this, there's some things that we have seen throughout that kind of marry that social media profile to your duty job, right?
Mm-hmm. It can, you know, the law is not crystal clear. And I know lawyers are supposed to have a crystal ball where we're supposed to be able to tell you exactly what's going to happen. But there's a lot of factors involved in whether or not someone engages in something off duty, whether or not it is going to be able to splash back and affect them. You know, certainly, and I'm talking short of criminal, there's obviously there's some, you know, problems criminally when you're off duty and you get in trouble, but things that are short of a criminal offense still can, and especially today. I mean, society today is, it's funny, we're supposed to be more tolerant, but it seems like we're less tolerant. And, we're fully tolerant of people who believe what we believe, but people who don't believe what we believe, we're not tolerant of. So, and that creates a little bit of a friction point with the First Amendment and some of the other protections that people may have. So it's a difficult area.
Go ahead, Brad.
Sorry, I was going to jump in here. Yeah, I mean, David. So you mentioned something about the First Amendment there. And one of the things that I always try to jump in and tell our people is, you know, while freedom of speech means that you can have freedom of speech, it doesn't mean freedom from consequences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's something important for people to make sure that our people understand as employees that they are held to a little bit of a higher standard.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. And then, you know, when we think about the First Amendment, the First Amendment actually says Congress shall make no law. You know, that's the first thing. So it doesn't, there's a question about, or there was a question at one time, it's not a question anymore, about whether or not it applied to the states. And obviously now today it does apply to the states and it applies to political subdivisions of the state. But it was generally a restriction on government's ability to censor what people were saying. And the courts wrestled with this. They wrestled terribly with it. In fact, they're still wrestling with it about, you know, and it's funny, they all say the same thing, you know, when it comes to the cases, they all say the same thing that, you know, public employees do not lose their First Amendment right just because they take a job. They just say the same words that, you know, public employees do not lose their First Amendment rights because they take a government job, comma. However, in this case, they stepped over the line. And it's just, it's, you know, like, why even say that? You know, because in theory, we have a First Amendment right, but the application of it is anything but simple. I mean, you know, it's, I say when it comes to the First Amendment, right, the big test that we have is this thing called the Pickering balancing test. The only people like the Pickering balancing test are judges and law professors, because it screws everybody else. Judges love it because they get to second guess after something has happened. They get to second guess it. Law professors get to come up with these wonderful hypotheticals because they deal in, you know, hypothetical world, and they can dazzle their students with how brilliant they are by these hypotheticals. Okay, but if you're a fire chief trying to write a social media policy that complies with the First Amendment, or even worse, you're a firefighter sitting at your computer trying to say, "Can I say this? Am I protected? Am I not?" That Pickering balancing test is a disservice. And when I lecture on this and I go through all the different parts of it, my emphasis to the firefighters is don't roll the dice. Don't roll the dice. You know, it's not worth it to you. You've got a job, you got health care, you got a pension. Don't jeopardize that. That in and of itself could be a little bit of a censorship. Okay, which shouldn't be happening, but the Pickering balancing test is a god awful test, and you know, happy to go through it in detail, but I'm afraid I'd put the three of you to sleep if I tried. So
I feel like you're getting into your books, but that are behind you for that.
Yeah. Right. So I understand the Pickering balancing test. So basically, you know, just for the listeners, is they kind of weigh the person who makes the post interest against how it impacts the organization.
Yeah. But how do you predict that? My point is, how do you predict that? And it's a funny thing because I end up dealing with a lot of firefighter discipline and discharge. Okay. And we have a principle in the law called due process that someone cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And one of the principles, a lot of different principles embodied in due process, but one of them is that government cannot establish a rule that is vague or ambiguous, or they can't enforce a rule that's vague or ambiguous. Now, go ahead and go through and take what you just said about the Pickering balancing test and try to incorporate that into a policy. Because I've tried. You can't do it. Any way you write it, it's going to come out vague or ambiguous. So in other words, the Supreme Court on one hand is saying, you got to do this balancing test. On the other hand, if Congress had wrote that or a fire chief puts it in a policy, the Supreme Court's going to strike it down as vague or ambiguous. So it's a god-awful test. And again, law professors love it, so they won't criticize it. Judges love it because they get to second guess everybody after the fact. But for the fire chief who's struggling to work on the policy and the firefighter or the medic or whomever, a government employee who's trying to do the right thing and know where I'm protected, where I'm not, it's a terrible test.
So let's get into some of the dangers itself. So I think if you could just go to the fire law blog and actually run through a few of your things and find a couple of these. But One of the things key and first and foremost, don't take pictures of your patients.
Well, that'd be a good idea. But if you do not share them. You know, they need to be archived. They need to be treated as part of the patient care report. And they need to be preserved. They're potentially evidence in many cases. And you're not really in a position to really judge whether or not there's going to be a lawsuit down the road. So you have to assume it's going to be evidence. If you take a picture, it's got to be treated as the patient care report. So if you could post the patient care report on the internet, well, I guess you could post the picture, but I'm thinking you can't.
Now, but that does put in a good conversation point, and I'm glad you said it like that, because one of the things that I discuss is, sometimes it is very difficult for us to translate exactly what condition we saw this patient in on scene, and we're going into the hospital. And I use one example that I had, in which the patient seemed okay, but I took a picture of the driver's side compartment after we had moved the patient out, and it was the fact that they saw almost 30 inches of intrusion on that roof compartment, in which they kind of changed their level of concern for that patient. But as you so. This none of this is really designed to scare that individual to not utilize these resources to pass on and make sure we're an advocate for our patient. It's just only making sure that they end up in the right place.
Exactly. And, I call them mechanism of injury pictures, but those are appropriate. I would recommend that the department have a policy on it, that we don't want cowboys just saying, hey, I think I'll take a mechanism of injury picture. And by the way, it's pretty good. So I think I might share it to show off that I went to this incident that's in the newspaper. So everybody knows I went there. And I think that's fundamentally a problem right there, with people that they're trying to glamorize their role in some major incident and show off that they were there. But that's another issue. But the mechanism of injury pictures are fine. They should be done pursuant to a policy. Okay. Now here's another part that can happen. Okay. That you have a well-intentioned ER doc that gets the picture and tells the medic, okay, thank you, you can delete that off your camera or delete that off your device. We're government employees. And when we go to an incident scene, we're acting as government employees, and we have this thing called the public records laws. It might be called the Freedom of Information Act. There's a bunch of different, names for it. But essentially, when you're a government employee and you're involved in your employment and you take a picture, the resulting picture is a public record. Now, there may be reasons why we may not have to disclose it. That's a separate issue. There's a lot of exceptions. Usually HIPAA-protected information is protected from disclosure. However, there are laws that say if you delete a public record before what's called the record retention period ends, it's a criminal offense in many states. In other states, in my state, you can be fined for it, but the Attorney General's office can fine you. I think it's $500 a picture. But many states, it's a criminal offense to destroy a public record. So the well-intentioned doctor, tremendously brilliant, I'm sure, but hasn't been to law school and doesn't know about public records and tells you to delete the picture, may actually lead you down the road to committing a criminal offense. So, you know, that's why we don't want individual medics and EMTs doing all the thinking on this. We want the chief, the leadership, in conjunction with local legal counsel and HR, drafting the policy on this and coming up with something that's going to make sure that we have the pictures for when we need it, the mechanism of injury picture, but it's going to comply with any of the law, privacy laws, HIPAA, medical confidentiality laws, and the public records law as well.
And this is where, like, our EPCRs now, many of them have that attachment that you can put a miscellaneous attachment. So if you move that off, but you do secure it as part of that PCR, you can still delete that at that point because you've already attached that to that record.
Right? Look at that technology, right? Somebody figured this out. Yeah.
So I do want to, you bring up a great point there with the public records or the FOIA request or the Freedom of Information Act request. Just because, so even if that does target that specific picture, I do know that there's a lot of misconceptions out there about if I do use my personal device and it subsequently gets called into question under one of the Public Records Acts, that gives them access to everything on my phone at that point in time. And that's not a correct statement either.
It depends on the state. And here's how some states are just nanny state, whatever you want to call them, but they're just over the top sometimes with their bureaucratic regulations. But some states reserve the right to audit any account that is used for governmental purposes. Okay. And what they mean by an account would be if you use your personal email for business once in a year, that opens up their ability to audit your personal email to determine whether or not you sent multiple emails. That doesn't mean they're going to, and it doesn't mean they could come in and seize your computer, but following whatever procedure they have set up by state law, they can require you to have your account audited. Okay. Same thing with your cell phone. Okay. So you have a cell phone, you took a picture with the cell phone. You said it was just one over the course of a year, you took one work-related photo. It's possible, whether it's the Secretary of State or the Attorney General, whoever oversees the public records in there, that they could come in and demand the right to audit what's on your phone. Now, does that mean they can come in and seize your phone? No. It means that whatever procedure they have set up, they have the right to call you in and go through the pictures with you. In some states, that right to do that audit is pushed down. Not only does it reside in the Attorney General or the Secretary of State, but the government agency that you work for may also have the right to do that kind of an audit. So again, not every state has it that involved a process for it. So, and the idea that somebody can come and take your cell phone is totally wrong. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled recently that our expectation of privacy in our personal phone exceeds the expectation of privacy we have in our personal home. You think about that for a second. The greatest place that we as Americans have an expectation of privacy is in our home. Government cannot come in our home and ransack our home and look for things, go around looking for problems. They get a search warrant. It's got to tell them, number one, what are they looking for? Why do they believe it's there? and specifically where they're going to search. It's the same principle if they want to look at your phone. They can't just come in and take your phone, number one, and just go rummaging around in your phone. They'd have to get a search warrant. Again, that's where there have to be a procedure for them to do this.
So as you are, you know, we've all probably seen the images that have been included in training videos and such of bodies, and you know, they'll have the face draped, but just because that face is draped or you left it out of the image, other scene indicators, you know, the time it was, what type of incident, etc., may give enough clues. And that kind of leads, while you think you've left privacy intact, you really haven't, because there's enough indicators throughout those images that, and when you post it onto social media, that people can still gather what that is, right?
Absolutely. And I could tell you, I think the best way to handle freedom of information requests of any document is to have your lawyer review it, because in most states, you can't just say, for example, let's use an EMS report. Let's use your patient care report. If someone puts in a public records request for that report, you can't say, nah, we're not giving it to you. It's a HIPAA protected. You can't do that. You can't do that. What you have to do is you have to go through the report. You have to look at the state law on public records, and then you have to redact each item. And when you redact it, you're supposed to cite, we're redacting this because of Rhode Island General Laws 2742.6. I'm just making up numbers now, but basically you've got to cite where you have the right to redact that. So a typical patient care report is going to say whatever it says at the top, the Providence Fire Department patient care report, then you're just going to see a bunch of blanks, because virtually everything on it is going to be somehow redacted. Now, there may be some information, but a lot of it's going to be redacted. But if they ask for the report, you can't just say, we're not giving you the report. Now, you can redact whatever you're entitled to redact. You know, why am I saying that? It's the same thing with pictures. Okay, you can't just say, well, that's a mechanism of injury and it shows the victim's face, therefore we're not going to give it to you. No, you're going to have to give it, but you're entitled to redact what the law allows you to redact.
All right. So we've talked about several of the dangers. Let's go to the kind of the less obvious and what people think maybe a little bit safer to necessarily post. So posting again, you know, that, you know, we've all kind of seen the pictures here lately. You know, you think your job's hard, look at mine, and it's the back of an ambulance, and it's got, you know, blood everywhere. It's got, you know, all the wrappers for all the supplies and everything in the back of the ambulance tore up. And that too, even without patients and stuff, that may violate policies or potential laws there too, right?
It could. I would be thinking that it's more a policy. I can't imagine a law. I can't imagine a law being violated. But I think it would be the agency's policy.
And then we kind of get into, and this is where I kind of got one of my first lessons about the first things first. If you get into a fight on social media, it doesn't matter whether you win or you lose, you're always going to lose. My conversation was one about a Trendelenburg position, and another experienced paramedic was talking about how great it worked, and you know, presented with evidence, and it kind of devolved, and I realized it didn't matter what it was going to be, he was going to be right. And you know, so even when we look at these, and it could be, again, because of we might even be off duty, but because we may have pictures in our shirts and or, you know, I work at, you know, XYZ fire department or ambulance service, we need to make sure that social media remains professional. It remains in that, as you kind of mentioned earlier, you know, we kind of get held to a higher standard there. So we want to make sure that things such as sexual harassment, racism, disagreements, and devolvements into just name calling, etc. Those aren't appropriate. They may not hit a law. Some of them may, but we do have to be very cautious about that, whether we're on duty or not.
Yeah, I mean, the First Amendment, going through the Pickering balancing test, you have First Amendment protect. In order to qualify for First Amendment protection, there's two big things you got to think about. And number one, you have to be discussing a matter of public concern. And secondly, you have to be doing it as a private citizen. Now, if you can hit those two boxes, then you move into the balancing test. But if you can't hit those two checkboxes, you don't have a First Amendment protection. So if you're squabbling about a something that's personal or petty or private, like a private little squabble that doesn't really affect the public, there's no First Amendment protection right off the bat. And you could potentially be disciplined for, and I'm not saying you would be, but you lose the First Amendment protection. So that's number one. Stay away from petty disagreements, private disagreements, personal types of disagreements. And then you want to make sure that you do it as a private citizen. So, Bradley, when he went through my bio, said that I'm with the Exeter Fire Department. Okay. And, you know, I maintain a pretty high profile on social media, and I have a Facebook page, and you won't find anything about the Exeter Fire Department on my Facebook page for a reason. Okay. And so I'm trying to stay as a private citizen. Now, if I post one picture of me on my Facebook page in my Exeter turnout gear, or maybe my dress uniform or whatever it may be, does that now cause me to lose my status as a private citizen? Is it two pictures? Is it three pictures? Is it three pictures of my rank and title? How much? And again, this is where, you know, lawyers like to pretend we have a crystal ball, but you know, there's a lot of factual nuances that are going to cause a case to go one way or the other that are just almost impossible to predict. So again, if you're speaking as a private citizen, talking about the Trollenberg position, and you're doing it as a private citizen, and I think you can make a good faith argument that that's not a petty or personal grievance, that that's really a matter of public concern. The public may not know what it is, but it is a matter of public concern. Then at least you're teed up to have First Amendment protection. But sometimes folks devolve into things that are, I didn't get a promotion, or I should have had a call back tonight, or I should have gotten the overtime and I'm getting cheated, and you know, the chief's a jerk and all that. And then there's a question, well, you know, whether you got overtime tonight or tomorrow night, that's not a matter of public concern. And it doesn't warrant you getting First Amendment protection. So
I got some about that. Do you find that there is a cultural difference with EMS and fire in our relationship with social media than like our healthcare colleagues, like physicians, assistants, and doctors? Now, this is just my own observations, but I don't see physicians and PAs and nurse practs getting on their thing going, oh, hey, let me tell you about the coolest, you know, thing. And I'm not downing our own industry. It's just our industry is still technically in its infancy, the EMS side, not the fire side.
Sure.
And do you think that maybe that's another part of the issues we have, is it's a cultural issue too? We like having those Facebook pages that are a little salty and some downright raunchy that you don't see in our other allies.
Well, are you saying on the EMS side they're raunchy?
Yeah, well, yeah. Like well, you know, Facebook groups, Instagram accounts, things like that, where they go out of their way to be expletive about our industry.
Like, wow, I would have thought it went. I thought you were going to go the other way. I thought you were going to say that EMS was not as raunchy as firefighters, because firefighters are, you know, it's like sometimes it's like the worst frat house on campus, you know, with the firefighters and, you know. So my son we're starting to get paramedics now. We're actually getting quite a few, but he was an EMT cardiac, and he worked on a private ambulance and got on a career fire department, and he's now a surgeon, by the way. So that's, I guess, the end of the story here. So, but he's getting ready now for his fellowship. He wants to go to be a trauma surgeon, which we're very proud of. But I tend to think that, particularly on the private sector side, that they're much more careful and attentive to things like HIPAA than what we see in public sector firefighters. I know FDNY had an enormous scandal with picture taking years ago, back in 2010 to 2012 or so. And I know other departments have as well. It was EMS people trying to outdo each other with the outrageous pictures. So, and there's a couple, was it in North Carolina or was it Florida? I'm trying to think, it's Florida. They got charged criminally. They were posing with,
patients unconscious. So,
it's good for lawyers, man. It's good for lawyers, but it's not good for anybody else.
Well, and so one of the other things we kind of talked about before all,
I don't know
this,
if I answered Eric's, I don't know if I answered Eric's question, by the way, I hate to.
No, that's good. That answers, yeah.
But I do think, and I'll tell you some stories with my son. Just even, you know, the New England Patriots are, you know, 20 miles north of Providence. And, you know, there's some questions about if someone who was on the sidelines, a doctor or someone who worked at the hospital, maybe they were in the stands, but if they took a picture of somebody hurt, and that patient ended up being transported to that hospital, would HIPAA apply? And the doctors were actually debating, we're not going to take a chance, because if we paid for tickets at the New England Patriots game and somebody breaks their leg, this actually happened, okay? And somebody takes a picture of the person being wheeled off, that's a patient, it goes to their hospital. The doctors don't want to, you know, take a chance. I think, as I recall, what happened was, and maybe it wasn't the Patriots, but it was another football game where someone posted a picture of a football player, and it was national TV. He got hurt, and you know they posted the picture on the fire department's Facebook page of the firefighters wheeling the guy out, and then there was a question: was that a violation of HIPAA? You know. So at any rate, I think I know how my son is, and I know how he's been trained at the hospital and through medical school. So I'm sorry.
No, I mean, that's exactly what this is about, though, is kind of prioritizing those. And while it's, like you said, we, you know, if you look at what people just watch on TV, and, you know, it draws attention to see that deformed arm or you know, blood or something like that, people obviously get attracted to that. It's like, hey, look at what I saw, and you know, not necessarily the best thing. So going completely a different direction altogether, it can, social media can also serve as evidence that you lied. So I call into you, chief, at your fire department. It's like, hey, chief, sorry, not feeling good today. Can't come in, and you take your picture at the top of the Matterhorn before you come over the edge, and you're at your Disneyland instead of at home recovering, and that can technically be used against you as well.
As long as it's obtained legally, yeah. And you know, law enforcement really has a big problem with this. You know, we don't have to testify that often, but police officers are in court on a daily basis, and defense attorneys are, I mean, they are like focused on social media, so that, you know, if one of you was a police officer and you arrested one of my clients, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be doing everything I can to look at things that my client is African American and you've posted something that could be racist, man, you know, I want that. And, you know, and I'm going to use it to leverage whatever I can get for my client, you know? And I think that we have to, you know, if you arrest one of my clients for drunk driving and here you are inebriated, maybe it was 10 years ago, maybe it was 5 years ago, but you know, is this you? You know, because we're gonna bring it right into the courtroom. So I think police officers are confronted with that a lot more than we are. But certainly in discipline, whether it's use of sick leave, other types of things as well. You know, I've got a number of cases on my mind that it just their client confidence that I can't share with you. But it's, you know, there's no shortage of cases out there.
So as we kind of come down to the last section here, we've kind of danced around the subject quite a bit, but I'm going to bring in your website here as well. So if you're talking about leadership of fire emergency services, really any of these public safety entities, including law enforcement, emergency management, first and foremost, we need to sit down and write policy. That needs to be spelled out. And as you mentioned, you know, while they kind of go synonymous, because most of the time with social media, it comes along with that digital imagery as well. You need to have that social media policy and then the digital media policy as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Now, just a little plug for you here. If you need any assistance, you can go to a website called the Fire Law Blog. And there is a social networking policy, and then there's also photography and digital imagery as part of your free tools that are on there as well. So, you know, you need to sit down and draft your policies, and then it's not enough to just draft the policies. You've got to make sure then that they're disseminated and trained on and understood before you can hold anybody accountable.
Absolutely. And again, I don't want to have to hold anybody accountable. I want them to understand what they're facing, what I as the fire chief am facing, so that we're all on the same page, so that you don't get in trouble, so I don't have to do anything. I don't want to see you get in trouble. This isn't meant to, you know, hurt your fun and your love for the job. I don't want to see you get in trouble. And one of the things that I do, I know I'm part of Dave Statter's blog group, and Dave does the same thing, is that when there is a high profile or even a low profile social media case, we'll blog about it and we'll put all the resources we can possibly get, whether it's a decision, a ruling, a complaint, whatever we can, up on the blog, and enough detail so that folks can use that information to do maybe you're not going to do a 2-hour class on social media, but you can do maybe a 5-minute around the coffee pot. Hey, did you see this case out of, you know, the Smithville Fire Department? See, the firefighter posted this. Now he's getting fired. This group's upset about it and that. So that it gives officers and right, like even at the company level, the opportunity to have that sort of informal training opportunity on these cases.
And so once you get there, because I do think that a lot of this is kind of, as you said, there's no training, there's no education at the beginning. We teach them how to cut vent holes. We tell them how to horizontal, vertical ventilate. We go through all these different things. But again, from the very beginning, they really don't know when to use, when not to use. And so then the next part would be, you know, when should that camera actually come out? And you've talked a lot about those mechanism pictures. We want to be able to pass on. We want to be able to advocate. So we don't want to get to the point where we say, look, pulling out that phone is a bad idea. You know, mm-hmm. pulling out that phone may be the best thing that patient receives, because you can actually accurately convey what that patient has been through. But with that, this is your parameters about how to use that. And this is how to protect yourself. Because again, one more time, you just mentioned it, that, you know, none of this is a punitive side. This is providing the guidance to make sure that you are successful as a provider. We are successful as the leadership. The organization maintains success and is able to stay around and do their job. And everything is safe. So setting those parameters, making sure only use that camera when it's necessary. And then the last couple of things real quick before we wrap up is just make sure that social media represents who you are. So as you mentioned, you know, if you have somebody that you're running the risk may, you know, has arrested that African-American. Do they have a history of this? Are they showing that? So make sure it accurately represents who you are, and basically holding yourself to the same standards that others hold us to. So
yeah, there is one new technology that may help. I believe it's a little pricey right now, but there are apps out there. And I know my son was the first to tell me because he used it in the emergency room when he was still in medical school. But they basically, it's an app and it connects into the hospital's record keeping system, so that if he gets, because he's a surgeon and he gets called into the ER on a consult and maybe he's got somebody with an angulated fracture and he wants to take a picture of it now, and then it goes, but it doesn't go on his phone. He takes it through the app, doesn't keep a copy on his phone. It goes into the patient record, you know? So, you know, those types of technological solutions can solve that mechanism of injury type picture problem for us and maybe keep our folks from getting themselves in trouble. Now, one more thing that we didn't talk about, just I don't, you know, because we talk about pictures, is three states that I'm aware of that have criminalized picture taking at emergency scenes. It's New Jersey, Connecticut, and California. And I hope that those are the only states we see. I hope other states don't follow. But, you know, we want to be very, very attentive to whatever state law, the restrictions that state law puts on picture taking.
And that would go back to that policy development. And, yeah. You know, you've had your organization's attorney overlook it as well. So. Chief, as we wrap up, we'll give you a chance to just kind of give us your final thoughts and also let people know too about your website and some of the training courses that you do have available to help on these as well. So any final thoughts and then those classes you have would be great.
Well, I don't think the social media problem's going away. And we've kind of touched on that. And digital imagery, I think they're just making cameras better and smaller. I've got this little tiny one. It's over here somewhere. I mean, it cost me $1,000, but it's a little Sony camera. Takes phenomenal pictures, as good as my big Nikon camera does. Just incredible. So the technology is not going in a direction that's going to solve the problems. This just makes it easier for people to get themselves in trouble. So, and you know, one of my commitments to the fire service and EMS is to keep covering the cases and the stories that, you know, can help folks stay out of trouble in my blog. It's Fire Law Blog. And on Fire Law Blog, if you go to the bullet points tab, there'll always be some resource information there. Sometimes there's policies, sometimes there's bullet points and other things. And also on the courses tab, the courses that I'm doing, I do several courses on social media related topics. For example, how to draft a social media policy, how to draft a digital imagery policy. So, and I offer other courses. You'll see them if you go there.
All right. Well, thank you, Chief. And we'll kick over to Eric for any last thoughts that you have today, sir.
Yeah. So my big last thought would be to have a personal maxim for your online conduct. I mean, it's one thing to have a policy and to know the state laws and everything. The textbooks do not do you enough good for that. But just like you would treat your own license without the weight from your EMS service or the hospital that you work for, have your own personal conduct that you won't violate, so that you keep yourself out of as much danger as possible. And I think that's the big thing, is risk mitigation can go a long way if you have a personal maxim that you adhere to.
All right. Thanks, Eric. And we'll give you the last thought there, Bradley.
I'm just going to build on what Eric said. It's important to stay professional even when you're off duty. You can relax and do what you want to do at home, but the moment you go online, you are in the public eye.
All right. So one more time, thank you, Chief. And as we sign off today, we'd like to say that we always love recording these episodes and engaging with each one of you. However, without your feedback, we don't know what you're thinking. So please make sure to subscribe, rate, and review. and more specifically, find us on the EMS Handoff website at emshandoff.com. You can also reach out to us on our social media. We're on Instagram. We are on Facebook. Facebook is probably one of our most active as we're talking about this whole social media world right now. We talk about our Facebook group, so make sure and find us there. Don't forget to go and visit Pursue Outfitters and get your EMS Handoff gear. And on behalf of my co-host, Eric McCullough and Bradley Dean, this is David. Take care, stay safe, and always remember the value of your EMS Handoff.